Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, is a job that goes beyond, obviously, focused narrowly on our own country. It bears on relationships with other nations, allies most especially, among that group, the nation of Israel, a valiant and important partner in a very volatile and often very dangerous part of the world. To discuss what we can learn from what is going on in Israel and in the Middle East more generally, and insights for what is going on inside our own country, we're always delighted to be able to catch up with a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy, by my lights, one of the most brilliant authors and essayists and strategic analysts in either country, a woman who has hailed from this one and made Aliyah, as it's called, to Israel back in the 1990s. Her name is Carolyn Glick. She's an award-winning journalist, as well as, I say, a writer in various other modes, including two important books, Shackled Warrior in 2008, and more recently, The Israeli Solution, a one-state plan for peace in the Middle East in 2014. She is a columnist. She is the host of her own television program, podcast television. It's called The Carolyn Glick Show. And she contributes frequently to ours, for which we're very grateful, including for a full hour of her time today, which is a very special treat. Carolyn Glick, it's terrific to have you back. Welcome, and thank you for taking the time to do so.
Oh, it's always great to be on your program. Thanks for having me, Frank.
The pleasure is mine. Carolyn, one of the things that I value so much about catching up with you is you have an appreciation of strategic developments that are momentous not only for your adopted land of Israel, but also for your country of origin, the United States. One of those that I'd like to explore with you has been very much in the news of late. Well, frankly, in both countries, respectively, their Supreme Courts. I'd like to start with an update from you about what's been going on in Israel with respect to efforts that the Netanyahu government has been making to reform the Supreme Court so as to make it more consistent with its original purpose, namely to serve as a check and balance, as ours is supposed to do, on, you know, government and society writ large, something that it's ceased to do in the past decade or so. Talk us through what's the state of play there at the moment.
So thanks for the question, Frank. Well, the Supreme Court of Israel is the most powerful court, arguably in the world, certainly in the free world. And it's been kind of an inspiration for judicial activists in the United States for decades. In the 1990s, in 1992, 1995, the Supreme Court made two decisions that effectively gave itself unlimited power. And this was all kind of, while people were paying attention to other things, weren't really aware of the implications of what the Supreme Court had done. And what they did actually in 1992 was they orchestrated, the then Supreme Court Chief Justice Aaron Barak orchestrated the passage of a seemingly anodyne, not particularly important law in the Knesset called Human Rights and Human Dignity. And everybody just thought it was sort of a declarative law, but the Supreme Court subsequently interpreted this very kind of, you know, feel-good law, Israel protects human rights, Israel does this, Israel does that, to claim for the Supreme Court the power to abrogate laws of the Knesset and overturn decisions by the government. So executive decision and duly promulgated laws by Israel's parliament or Knesset, with no limits on that power. There's nothing in the law that gives it the right to do that. There's nothing, and anybody ever planned to give them the right to do that? Maybe if they had asked, maybe if there had been a discussion, then, you know, as in other parliamentary democracies, there might have been a limited judicial review granted to the court. I mean, in Britain, they don't have one. In Canada, they have, I think, a limited purview over the laws. In New Zealand, they have no judicial review. So that's one of the things that they did. And then the other thing that they did was they used this sort of aristocratic way of choosing judges by committee rather than, as you have in the United States, by elected officials, the president, and then approved by other elected officials in the Senate. Essentially, we have a judicial selections committee that chooses our judges on all three levels, the magistrate, the district court, and the Supreme Court. But the committee is actually controlled by Supreme Court justices who, together with the Bar Association, have a majority, and our elected officials who are on the committee have a minority. So they not only did they seize the powers of the executive to make decisions, to make policy, and the Knesset, our parliament, to pass laws, but they also seized for themselves the power to appoint themselves. So from being a co-equal branch of government, they became an oligarchy that's above government, that's above our elected officials. And in January, the government that ran on an election pledged to rein in the judiciary by placing minimal limits on their power that would sort of reduce them from the level of oligarchy to a co-equal or even a more equal, but still a member of the democratic way of doing things. The government proposed four different legislative package with four parts that together would have placed those limits on the court. And then the left in Israel went berserk.
This is a very comprehensive rendering of how we got to the present place, Carolyn. And it seems so reasonable that this idea that you want to have the judiciary play an appropriate role, of course, but have it be within limits and have it be consistent with a democratically elected executive and parliament, the Knesset, you know, doing their respective functions, not these judges, especially with this incestuous arrangement for their appointment. What does going berserk mean when you talk about the left in Israel's response to the Netanyahu proposals for reform?
So basically, we're having a reenactment here in Israel, and we've been having it for the past 4 months, of the sort of 2020 Black Lives Matter riots that you had in the United States, or the riots that we've seen in the streets of France over President Macron's efforts to raise the pension age from, I think, 62 to 65 in France. So where people are burning and having mass rallies and calling in Israel's case for international boycott of the Israeli government, making petitions to foreign governments like the United States to boycott the Israeli government. And President Biden, by the way, is participating in this. He said a couple of several weeks ago that he would not meet with Prime Minister Netanyahu, and indeed, Prime Minister Netanyahu hasn't been invited, as Israeli prime ministers generally are when they enter office, to meet with the U.S. president. So we've had 4 months of mass demonstrations against the government.
Carolyn, we'll have to take a short break. We'll be right back with more on what that means and what it suggests about what's happening here, too, right after this. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Daily now, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas offers fresh grounds for his impeachment. He not only laughably insists that our southern border is secure, he also asserts the Biden administration will be able to manage the countless additional illegal aliens now headed our way, despite Mayorkas's blithe assurances that his team has long been planning for the elimination of Title 42's pandemic-related restrictions, their actual plan is to invite and facilitate the coming human tsunami. Among those to be admitted and then distributed nationwide are untold numbers of apparently organized groups of young, unaccompanied, and uniformly equipped men from China. Ditto still others hailing from places like communist Venezuela and the world's jihadist regimes. That's a formula for mass destruction in America. Impeach Mayorkas and reconstitute and secure the border now. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We are visiting with Carolyn Glick, a very, very valued colleague of mine at the Center for Security Policy, a dear friend as well, but most especially an eminent thinker, author, and journalist concerning what is of great import, not just to the people of Israel, but also for us, in terms of development within the Jewish state, as well as in the region more generally. And Carolyn, you were just talking about a Summer of Love style, well, some would call it insurrection, taking place in the state of Israel. It's accompanied by comments from what you call the ruling class, the leadership of the political opposition, former general officers, and the like. How does that both animate what's going on here and make even more dangerous what's afoot?
So Israel's ruling class, broadly speaking, is our legal fraternity, our media fraternity, our academic fraternity, and our government service fraternity, as well as our general staff, which I think we're going to talk about in a bit. But basically, it's the permanent ruling class. It's what you call the United States, the deep state. And in Israel, in 1977, for the first time, we had a turnover of power from left to right, from the Labor Party to the Likud Party. After 29 years of consecutive labor governments, we got our first Likud government. The main reason for that is that the Labor Party lost the working class in Israel, and they never got it back. But to maintain effective control over the organs of the state, they kept their cadres in power in the government service. And over time,
the sort of permanent bureaucracy, in other words.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And as a left, and at the time, we had mainly state media. We had state television, state radio, army radio. We didn't have private stations. And over time, you've seen in the United States, you've seen in Europe, and also here in Israel, that the left has become post-nationalist and more radicalized against the concept of nationalism, of nation states, of the sort of the things that we've seen. And in America, it's been expressed in many ways over the past generation. And in Israel, it's been expressed in many ways in the past generation. On a policy level, it was the peace movement that embraced Palestinian terrorists as peace partners and ceded territory, enabling them to make a terrorist state in Gaza and in areas of Judea and Samaria. And then on the legal basis, it became the radicalization of our Supreme Court and of our legal fraternity more generally, that specifically includes law enforcement, the police, and the state prosecution and the attorney general's office. So they've become organs of the radical left, not just the left, and they use their unlimited powers to overturn executive decisions of the government and laws promulgated by our parliament to compel our elected officials to adopt policies of the left as the elected officials, even though they were elected to do something else, and then they sort of corral them into a corridor where they have no choice but to adopt the policies of the left, or, as we've seen with Prime Minister Netanyahu, face legal persecution in the form of fake indictments against him for fake crimes that are all falling apart in court. But in the meantime, they destabilize our political leadership. So that's what we've faced, that's what we're still facing in Israel. And so when the government came in with their limited agenda of judicial reform to try to force the courts back into the norms of a democratic society, the left, recognizing that this would be the end of their unelected but permanent control over policy, began their insurrection. So this wasn't about, they claim it's about democracy, but really what it's about is their power to dictate policy despite the fact that they lack the support of a majority of Israelis. And indeed, as we've seen in the last elections, which were a referendum on legal reform, you have an absolute majority of Israelis who think this is a voting issue and who voted on for this government because it pledged to enact, to place limits on the powers of our legal fraternity, our prosecutor and attorney general on the one hand, and our Supreme Court on the other.
And Carolyn, I guess what I was hoping to also add into this mix is what you use the term as well, the insurrection. As I understand it, leaders of the opposition, in their determination to try to derail even this modest judicial reform, have taken to calling for the overthrow of the government, a civil war to achieve that purpose, and even talk of assassination of the prime minister and members of his government. Is that right? And has that continued in the midst of the ongoing turmoil?
So several weeks ago, I think 3 weeks ago, Prime Minister Netanyahu stood down and he agreed to try to get to an agreement with the opposition parties on an agenda of judicial reform to try to quell the violence in the streets and the efforts by this mass movement that has just apparently unlimited amounts of money to riot and to hold mass protests with props, you know, very expensive ones. And they're completely supported by 90% of the Israeli media, which is part of sort of the leftist complex, very much like what you experience with the US media. So he suspended the legislative process, agreed to try to reach some sort of if not consensus, then a wide-ranging agreement by the government and the opposition on a program of judicial reform that would have wide agreement in Israel, not only among the absolute majority of Israelis that are represented by the government. So the problem with that is that even though most of the leaders of our opposition parties have at one time or another spoken and advocated and introduced even platforms of judicial reform that include several of the proposals that were on the table in the Knesset until it was suspended last month or late March, I can't remember exactly. Now they're completely opposed to it because it's part of their overall agenda of overthrowing the government and trying to force new elections. So we'll have to see where that goes. The government has pledged to return to its initial plan for judicial reform or some updated version of it if the talks that are now taking place under the aegis of Israel's president, who's sort of a ceremonially, it's kind of like our king, like along the lines of the King of England in powers, that is just ceremonial ones, but he's sort of seen as kind of somebody who is less aligned with either side and a fair broker, which is not necessarily correct. He's a former head of the Labour Party, but all the same, they agreed to this effort to reach a broad-based agreement. And if it works, fine. And if it doesn't work, then the voters have their expectations. They voted these people into office for a reason, and the reason is because it's time to limit the powers of our legal fraternity.
Carolyn, again, one of the reasons why I think this is so relevant to our program and our audience is, as you said earlier, the left would love to have a similar kind of judicial veto over everything in the government, especially as here as in Israel, it is losing, I think, the popular support that it has in the past enjoyed. We have to take another break, Carolyn. We'll be right back with more, and we're going to broaden the lens to several other topics with Carolyn Glick. Stay tuned for that and more in the area in particular, Carolyn, of the politicization of the security services. I think there's a lot of relevance to both countries. We'll be right back with that right after this.
Night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Carolyn Glick. She is an author of several important books, including Shackled Warrior, a topic that we're going to return to here in a moment. But in addition, she is a columnist and a blogger and, of course, the host of the Carolyn Glick Show. I commend all of these to you as resources from one of the most astute, thoughtful, and I think influential practitioners of national security policy, as well as raconteurs about it in the world today, for that matter. Carolyn, you went through a litany of deep state elements that have been involved in fostering this crisis in Israel in order to try to protect the power that the left has, particularly in this, rogue, I would call it, Supreme Court. I noted that you did not mention the security services or, for that matter, the Israel Defense Forces and the role that some elements of those have been playing. The recently leaked classified documents here in the United States indicated that our intelligence services understood that the Israeli intelligence services were actually encouraging some of this turmoil and opposition to the elected government. Talk about that. You served in the Israel Defense Forces yourself for some 5.5 years. What do you make of it? How serious a problem has it been, especially at a very dangerous moment for Israel in terms of external threats as well?
So thanks for that question. Israel has seen a profound politicization of the senior ranks of our military and our security services over the past generation. The genesis of this, in many ways, is the strategic dependence that Israel developed in the 1970s on the United States, as the United States began providing significant military assistance to Israel in both before and particularly in the aftermath of the 1973 Yom Kippur War. So the psychological and material dependence that Israel developed, and particularly our senior staff in the general staff and in the Mossad developed in the United States, and the CIA, the Pentagon and the CIA, really attenuated the power of the elected leadership of Israel to determine policy, because it, suddenly there was another actor on the field that was very, very influential and impactful on the thinking and the strategic horizons that the security brass in Israel was willing to adopt. In the 1990s, I talked about the peace process with the PLO, which was a phony peace process, as I laid out in my book, The Israeli Solution. But security services led the negotiations with the Palestinian Authority, with the PLO, and they became extremely politicized as a consequence of their placement at the helm of Israel's negotiating team. And so that also had a detrimental impact on their view of their loyalties and more broadly of what Israel's strategic options are, because they cultivated this idea that Israel's first and best option is to rely on the United States and its security guarantee, whereas the basis of American strategic support for Israel is Israel's strategic independence. So it's sort of this catch-22 that the U.S. security services and the Pentagon in particular cultivated strategic dependency on the part of Israel's generals on America. But the only reason that they were giving us military support to begin with was because we were strategically independent. And so the political leadership wants to be strategically independent. Our security brass that's psychologically and otherwise dependent on their colleagues in the Pentagon walk away from that concept towards a concept of an American-centric strategic doctrine. And then it comes back as a boomerang reinforcing it. And then that in turn can erode U.S. support for Israel because we act more like a client state than an ally. So this is sort of a loop that Israel's been in for several decades. And it's gotten progressively worse as the left in Israel, which is aligned with the top security brass in the army, has become more and more radicalized.
Yeah, this is really very disturbing because I think it has historically been the case that Israel has prided itself on both the independence of its policy and the independence of its capabilities. And the temptation has always been there. There was a time when Bill Clinton was offering to have U.S. forces on the Golan Heights to protect Israel rather than Israeli forces. And you can only imagine what a disaster that would have been in the midst of all this Syrian civil conflict and the like. But I remember there was a famous quote of Golda Meir, the iconic Israeli prime minister, when Richard Nixon at one point offered her security guarantees, and she said something to the effect of, "Mr. President, the problem with your security guarantees is by the time you get here, we won't be here." And to have the Israeli military seemingly losing sight of that reality and making themselves more subordinate, more dependent upon our military.
I can give you another story just to give you a sense of how difficult it is. In 2008, when Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were vying for the Democratic nomination for president, Hillary Clinton, before the Pennsylvania primary, which is very important, gave a speech before a Jewish audience who she was wooing for votes. And she said that if Iran nukes Israel, then the United States will nuke Iran. And they all cheered. And I listened to this and I thought, this is the worst thing I've ever heard in my life, right? I mean, what good does it, what do we care if the United States nukes Iran after we're already gone? That's a terrible thing to say, but she, in her exhilaration at the concept that she was going to threaten the use of nuclear weapons, she gave away the game, right? Which is that the United States views Israel as number one on the target list that Iran has for its nuclear weapons program. And the United States isn't going to do anything about Iran's nuclear weapons program until and unless it's number one. So Israel, instead of recognizing this, our security brass has for years insisted that this isn't just Israel's problem, that Iran's nuclear weapons program correctly, they say that it constitutes a threat to all of the countries in the world and the region and the United States and Europe. This is correct. But what they fail to recognize, because they don't want to recognize, as far as I can tell, and because they're being told something by people in Washington that are misleading them as well, is that they don't understand what Hillary Clinton said in that speech before the Jewish audience in Pennsylvania in 2008. And that, I think, is really the key to understanding the problem here.
It is. And I think that story is instructive on so many levels. And again, to the extent that your military has been politicized and has, in fact, been weaponized by the left, and seemingly, to some extent, by that U.S. Counterpart, political counterpart, as well as military counterpart, it augurs very ill, I think, for the state of Israel, for its freedom of action, for its ability, in fact, to defend itself, rather than to rely on what has, unfortunately, especially under this administration, proven to be a rather unreliable America. And we're going to talk about that in the context of the current state of affairs with respect to Iran and the dangers that it now poses, not just to Israel, obviously, but also, as you said, Carolyn, to the rest of the world and us in particular. Carolyn, the thing that's so troubling about this is that if you look at the U.S. government's role at the moment, particularly vis-a-vis the most serious threat, arguably, that faces Israel and others in the region, but also threatens us, would be the Islamic Republic, as they call themselves, of Iran. They are now, as you know, Carolyn, we call them, I guess, a threshold nation, meaning, to those who parse these things over much, in my judgment, that they could have a nuclear weapon at any time, but they haven't actually taken the steps to put it all together in a workable bomb. I don't personally credit that, but it does give people a basis for saying, well, we can continue to do business with them. That's not generally the case, I think, in Israel, but does the idea that we would see Israel depending upon the United States for its security raise in your mind a question as to whether or not Israel would be essentially precluded from acting in its own defense against that very dangerous development?
Well, one of the administration officials was speaking, I think it was before Congress last week, and said that the United States would support Israel, an Israeli attack against Iran, if Iran had a fieldable nuclear weapon or something.
I think that was General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Yeah.
And later, I think it was Secretary Blinken who said something along words to that effect. The basic concept is a little bit problematic. I mean, it's very problematic because I've... Mm-hmm.
Carolyn, we have to take a break. I want to come back to why it's so. We have to take...
Okay, great.
Just a short break. Stay tuned, folks. We'll be right back with more. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Daily now, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas offers fresh grounds for his impeachment. He not only laughably insists that our southern border is secure, he also asserts the Biden administration will be able to manage the countless additional illegal aliens now headed our way. despite Mayorkas' blithe assurances that his team has long been planning for the elimination of Title 42's pandemic-related restrictions, their actual plan is to invite and facilitate the coming human tsunami. Among those to be admitted and then distributed nationwide are untold numbers of apparently organized groups of young, unaccompanied, and uniformly equipped men from China. Ditto still others hailing from places like communist Venezuela and the world's jihadist regimes. That's a formula for mass destruction in America. Impeach Mayorkas and reconstitute and secure the border now. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We're talking with Carolyn Glick about some of the most portentous developments in the world, certainly in our time, and those would be in the Middle East, and the evident transformation of Iran from a nation that has long aspired to have nuclear weapons to having the capability to have nuclear weapons. And we're going to discuss whether there's a difference between having that capability and actually having the bomb. Carolyn, you were talking a little bit about how this is perceived in Israel, this idea of Iran being somehow a threshold nation that isn't actually armed yet with nuclear weapons and therefore not a problem for Israel. If that's the position of the United States government, it seems to me it's preposterous and dangerous, but is it now acceptable to Israel as well?
No, it's not acceptable to Israel at all. And I dare say it's not acceptable to the Israeli left either. The question is what to do about it. My personal view, and I'm an outspoken advocate of supporting the Iranian people in their efforts to overthrow their government, because I think that, you know, once the regime, God willing, is overthrown, then a lot of things that they are the head of the stink. I mean, they're behind almost every single one of the conflicts that we've been experiencing, that you've been experiencing, the Americans in the Middle East, in Central Asia, since 1979, since the Islamic Revolution in 1969. And so I think that overthrowing the regime is really, obviously there are no panaceas in this world, but overthrowing that regime gets rid of the most dangerous source of war, of nuclear proliferation, of unconventional weapons, and of terrorism in the world. And I think that that would be a very good thing. And obviously, it's very important for Israel. Unfortunately, we really do see that the United States is not even enforcing the sanctions that have already been enacted against the Iranian regime. Israel and the United States do not see eye to eye on Iran. I don't think it really matters where the IDF comes down on this so much as it may have in the past, because I think that Iran has gotten so advanced in their nuclear efforts that the daylight, as Obama once used the term, between the Israeli security brass and the government on this issue is much smaller than it was in the past.
And as you say, there's general unanimity among the political parties on this subject, too. Carolyn, I wanted to ask you in this connection about something we talked about with our colleague, Dr. Harold Rode, the other day. And that was the visit to Israel of Reza Pahlavi II, the son of the last Shah of Iran. Give us your sense of both what was said and done during that visit and its import for precisely the kind of policy approach that you're recommending and that I personally very much subscribe to as well.
I think that the visit to Israel by Reza Pahlavi was extremely significant because it sent a very clear signal to the regime and to the Iranian people that Israel supports regime change in Iran. This has not been Israel's policy in the past. We've limited our approach to Iran to working to undermine the nuclear weapons program through various means, both on the ground in Iran and internationally, through lobbying of various governments and through developing strategic ties with various nations in the region, whether it's Azerbaijan, most recently in Turkmenistan, which border Iran, or Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, Sudan, and other states. But I think that hosting the crown prince, essentially, of Iran in Israel was a very clear signal that Israel supports the revolutionaries on the ground in Iran. And by the way, I don't think that Israel is a monarchist, you know, in the sense that people say, oh, what are you saying that you support the reintroduction of the monarchy in Iran? I mean, the truth is we don't really care. That really is entirely up to the people of Iran, how they want to govern themselves. The fact is that over 80% of Iranians oppose the regime and want to see its overthrow, according to the data, you know, that's been collected, obviously very problematic, but also, you know, that is the widely accepted percentage of the Iranian people, the bare minimum of the Iranian people that oppose this regime and seek revolutionary change in their country. So I think that, you know, standing with a prominent symbol of resistance to the regime is really probably a better characterization of what Israel did. You know, we've had rallies all over the country since last September when Mahsa Amini was murdered by the regime for not wearing a head covering, in support of the women of Iran in their quest for freedom from the regime that enslaves them. So I think, you know, that was the most important thing about Pahlavi's visit to Israel, that I think it signaled very clearly that Israel is willing to support the Iranian people in their efforts to overthrow the regime.
Yeah, I think it's a critical step. And to the extent that it represents a change in policy on the part of the Israeli government, I think it's highly commendable. Caroline, this is happening against the backdrop of, as you indicated earlier, the malevolent activities of Iran in the region continuing to metastasize. The latest attacks by their proxies in Gaza, Hamas, and most especially in this case, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, has precipitated the latest round of, you know, exchange of fire. The Israelis, you know, once again, I have to say, it always astonishes me when you look at the nature of Gaza, this densely packed, mostly, you know, slum area with a population that is, you know, heavily concentrated, to say the least. Israel's ability to precisely attack and take out elements of the enemy without mass casualties. I mean, they always talk up such casualties as are inflicted, but it's generally minimal. And it's certainly in stark contrast to the efforts of the people precipitating this violence, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad in this case, to do as much damage to the civilian population of Israel as they can. Carolyn, I want you to comment on that on the other side of this last short break. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to this final installment of our hour-long conversation with the great Carolyn Glick. And Carolyn, we were just talking about the extent to which we have witnessed yet again the contrast between Israel trying to deal with the actual and dangerous threat now growing from Gaza with precision and trying to avoid civilian casualties wherever possible, and the attacks, by contrast, by Palestinian Islamic Jihad aimed clearly at killing as many Israeli civilians as they can. This is an important distinction. How does it bear on more generally the threat that we're seeing from not just Iranian proxies, but also Iran itself to Israel?
I mean, I think that the entire concept of indiscriminate firing of rocket, missiles, and mortars at civilian population centers, it just tells you everything that you need to know about Islamic Jihad and about Hamas, which does the exact same thing, and about Hezbollah that does the exact same thing. I mean, these people just want to kill Jews. That's like, that's all they want to do. They want to annihilate the Jewish state. They don't care. Every single one of these rockets, under international law, which everybody always accuses Israel of breaking wrongly, slanderously, but every single one of the rocket launches, and just this past several days, we've had 1,200 of them, is under the laws of war, a separate war crime. And, you know, nobody talks about that. Israel, on the other hand, this past campaign in particular, we've had a one-to-one ratio of civilians and terrorists killed, which is, again, this is something that's unprecedented in the history of warfare. So Israel's only going after the terrorists, and the civilians that were just killed were the people who were their human shields. They're the ones that they're protecting themselves with. They have four-year-olds who are dancing around rocket launching sites because they want to try to force Israel to kill children. That's how sick they are.
Talk to me about, as a result of all of this, the prospects for contending really in a permanent way with these sorts of threats that Iran is, as you say, enabling, in the absence of a policy that actually results in the end of the Iranian regime. It seems, as you've indicated, the alternatives are not very good. But is that now a consensus position, would you say, in Israel? And what policies do you anticipate the Israeli government will be pursuing going forward to try to help bring about the end of the Iranian mullahs and their theocracy?
Well, you know, in addition to my other hats that you mentioned, of writing books and working with you at the Center for Security Policy and the Carolyn Glick Show that I host every week, I'm also the senior editor at Jewish News Syndicate, which is a news website in English about news in Israel and in the Jewish world more generally, JNS.org. And in my column recently, I explained that, you know, what we're facing is a multi-pronged assault by Iranian proxies on Israel, whether it's Islamic Jihad or Hamas or Hezbollah or even the Assad regime in Syria. All of these are puppets, and they're all controlled by the puppet masters in Tehran. And by the way, that puppet master has a lot less firepower right now that they can directly attack Israel with. And because they're facing revolutionary violence at home and 80% of Iranians at a minimum who want to overthrow the regime, the weakest link in this nexus, in this chain that Iran controls, is Iran itself, is the regime itself. So I think that the idea of helping the Iranian people in their efforts, in their heroic efforts to overturn the regime, is probably the easiest thing that you can do. And it's not easy. Nothing is easy, but I mean, it's the least dangerous act that Israel can undertake right now. And as we talked about earlier in this discussion, I think that hosting Reza Pahlavi, the crown prince, essentially, of Iran, of a free Iran, in Israel was sent a very clear signal that that is the thing that Israel, you know, intends to advance. That's the main policy that we intend to advance, or one of the policies that we intend to advance in our confrontation with Iran. And as to Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah, Hamas, I think that so long as the regime exists, the best that we can do without risking a really disastrous regional war where we're going to be faced with, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of missiles an hour being shot at Iran by being shot at Israel by Iran's proxies, that would overwhelm our defenses, which are unprecedented themselves in the world. I think that we have to help the Iranian people, and then we have to strike out at specific significant targets. And we saw this strategy being undertaken this past week by the IDF against Islamic Jihad, specifically in Gaza. The attacks were against their leaders, against their terror masters, against their regional commanders, against their weapons stores, and infrastructure. So I think that what you saw was that the idea was that every target, aside from, going after people who are about to launch missiles to preempt them, was to cause a lasting and significant damage, and also to show, to demonstrate to Hamas and to demonstrate to Hezbollah the intelligence control that Israel has over Gaza and likely over Lebanon, to reinstate or to strengthen Israel's deterrent that has eroded over the past several months vis-a-vis Iran's proxies. So I think that those were that's the game Israel is playing, and those are the goals that it has laid for itself, as manifested by the actions that it's undertaken.
Carolyn, we've got about a minute left. I just want to ask you very quickly. Obviously, it's important that the United States be aligned with Israel in this effort. Just a quick closing comment from you on how Americans should view the need to help the people of Iran overthrow this regime, not just to help our friends in Israel, but for our own interests as well.
I mean, I think, again, Iran is the head of the snake. They were the ones who were behind the war in Iran, in Iraq, that, they killed thousands of U.S. forces in Iraq and in Afghanistan. They also were the chief sponsor of the Taliban throughout the 20 years that the United States was there. When you talk about overthrowing the Iranian regime, we're not talking about sending in forces, not Israeli and not American and not anybody else. It's simply to enable the Iranian people to give them the means to overthrow the regime. So this is a low-cost sure bet, something that we almost never see. And again, it's a sure bet, to my mind, no matter who takes over, just because even if they're bad, it'll take them a long time to seize control of all of these things, and 1,000 things can happen in the meantime.
We have to leave it at that. Carolyn Glick, thank you for your great work.
Thank you very much,
Frank. Thank
you
for being
part
of our team. Come back to us again with updates soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.